TFM.
This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Audible.com, your source for the best audiobooks, including unabridged readings of the latest novels from the incredible family of Star Trek authors. To get a free audiobook of your choice and help this show and the network at the same time, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm. And if you want to join the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode, join the Babel Conference, our listeners group on Facebook. Just type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the Facebook search field. We look forward to seeing you there.
Hi, this is Michael Dorn, Lieutenant Commander Worf from Next Generation and Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 232. What a genius that guy was. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Larry Nemechek. In this episode, airing on the 10th anniversary of this podcast's premiere, we look back at some of the topics we discussed a decade ago and how they have or haven't changed. In particular, we deep dive into Star Trek's return to television and how the prospects and probable format seemed in 2011 versus what we actually got, as well as which way the fan pendulum is swinging today. We also talk about screen versus visual canon, whether Star Trek is a historical piece, dealing with toxic fandom, the Con of Wrath, and more. So let's step into the Ready Room. Well, Larry, it's great to see you in the Ready Room, as always. I knew you'd be here because, you know, we've been hanging out in this place for 10 years now. Can you believe it? This marks a decade since I first set foot in this Ready Room, and we were talking about that. Thankfully, you reminded me, actually, and we decided we should record an episode and mark the occasion.
Well, golly, Mr. Peabody, where are we in the Wayback Machine today? We're in 2011. Yes, Peabody here.
May 31st, 2011 is the date that the first episode of the Ready Room was released, and then, Larry, you were on episode 2 1 week later.
Yeah. I was still calling you Christopher back then.
Yes, I noticed that when I think we both listened to some past episodes to prepare for our chat today. And yeah, I did notice that you were calling me Christopher.
Well, we started chatting. It was a combination of Star Trek and football, college football online.
College football.
I think it was Twitter that brought us together, maybe.
Yeah, it was Twitter. Yeah. And it was mainly college football at first, which probably surprises a lot of people, given our connections to Star Trek. And
but then there was the classic. What kills me also is I think the Ambojitsu tournament bowl game was either 2014 or 2015. But I've just been shocked. I think it was 2014, which shocks me. It was 7 years in January, which is just shocking to me now.
Yeah, and I still have that image that I made available on the computer so that I can tweet that out from time to time.
I'm just waiting for Ambojitsu was back on Lower Decks, wasn't it?
Yeah. That was a great callback.
They weren't wearing OU and Bama gear, though. But
right. And speaking of Lower Decks, that's something that 10 years ago, we could have never really imagined that we would have gotten. As we'll talk about today, we did make some predictions a decade ago that Star Trek would return to TV in animated form, but we did not predict that it would be a comedy.
Yeah, well, I mean, there are some things that it's kind of like imagining the paradigms and the technology, even when something changes in 10 or 20 years. It was a big thing in the 60s to have flip-top cell phones replacing regular phones, like on at the same time, Get Smart, having the parody of the shoe phone, right? But the whole point still was you could call somebody from wherever you were. It was just a secret agent gizmo, or it was a 23rd century, you know, comm device. At the time, it was like, that was future. Well, we've hit that. That was like the 90s. And now we're 20 years past that, you know, plus. But the things we're talking about 10 years ago, as far as media and Star Trek and all that, look what's happened in the, I mean, at the time.
Yeah.
I remember thinking how insane it was that original series were on HBO and they were up for Emmy Awards. That was like radically revolutionary. And then what happened? The company that used to send you DVDs in the mail of rare movies No sooner has the dust settled on HBO winning Emmy Awards than the company that sent you DVDs, Netflix, is making original programming. And, you know, the landscape changed so fast in the last 10, 15 years that it's but there's one thing in particular, and I want to get to it, that I was shocked, that I was saying in 2011, because I thought it came much later. So I'm very, you know, some things we missed, some things are blandly generic. I know you and Greg talked on the early episode earlier, and then we were on another one very soon after. But there's one thing here I'm just shocked that I was talking about, because it's exactly what came, or it was an option that could have happened. And it was like I was warning about it, and then it happened. So anyway, I look forward to this. This is going to 10 years, though, is amazing. Amazing, amazing.
Well, I'll have to say that 10 years down the road, you're really good at teasing people there, Larry, telling them, we're going to talk about this later. I was shocked, I say, but I'm not going to reveal right now what that thing was.
No, no, they have to sit through the weather and sports and three commercials before we get to it.
That's right. Well, the big things we're going to talk about today, primarily at Star Trek's return to TV. We went back, we listened to some of those early episodes, and there's a lot of interesting stuff that we talked about. But the thing that seemed to really connect May 31st, 2021 and May 31st, 2011 is the whole discussion of, will Star Trek come back to television? What form will it take? When will it happen? So that's going to be the main thing today. Before we get into that, Larry, I thought it would be interesting, some of those other things that we're not really going to discuss, I thought I would read a little bit of the synopsis for the very first episode of The Ready Room in our news segment. This is what we discussed in our news segment.
Of Ready Room
we
number one,
discussed possible
right?
villains. That's right. The Ready Room number one, the title of which is, It's a One-Parter. And the reason it's called It's a One-Parter is because it's like 2.5 hours long, I think. And Greg and I were so shocked that we talked for that long. It was our first podcast of like this kind of sit-down discussion type podcast. And as a joke, we named it, it's a one-parter, because you would think it would be a two-parter considering how long it was. But it was an Enterprise retrospective where we talked about Enterprise because we both loved the show. And at that time, especially, it was still very much in vogue among fans to really hate on Enterprise.
Bash
I think
it, yeah.
These days, it's not so much. A lot of people are warming up to it the way they did DS9. But back then, it was still...
Oh, yeah, it was a fresh memory.
The show that, yeah, people didn't like.
Well, and series that only went 4 years, so it was obviously a failure, and, you know, not seven.
Well, clearly. I mean, they only got 98 episodes out of it, so obviously it was a failure.
and went out on the Valentine to the fans that everybody, like, took one bite out of and put back in the Valentine candy box. Yeah.
Right. Yeah.
So
which,
to speak.
You know, interestingly, you know, our friend Una McCormick was doing a very rapid Enterprise rewatch over the past month or so. I think because she's writing the autobiography or maybe the authorized biography of Porthos. That's my guess based on, you know, because we've had, you know, the captain's ones coming out now.
Right. Well, so Una, you know, as I you suspect. Know, Una's a very, very thorough writer. She would never be one to just dog it on something like that.
There you go.
Hope I didn't give you cause for pause. Okay.
You remind me of one of my favorite podcasts, Big Picture Science from the SETI Institute, because Seth, especially on there, is really into that kind of pun and bad
weaponized
joke.
Weaponized puns. Okay.
Weaponized puns, exactly, yeah. The reason I bring up Una,
well,
though, is...
Let's cheese it and get on with something else. Okay.
You mentioned the last episode, and she said last week, I think it was, that this episode would have been fine if it had been placed earlier in the season, not at the end, which I thought was interesting because the way a lot of fans talk about it is that it's just a horrible episode in general and it should not have ever existed. But I do think the placement has a lot to do with it.
Yep.
If it hadn't, and not only...
If it hadn't been the emotional last episode with so much writing on it, and that's your last taste of the show and all of that.
Right. Yeah. And I'm sure you remember watching it in first run. It aired right after Demons. on the same night. You know, one finished and then we went right into this. Right. And that was a kind of an odd feeling as well, because you're left with a story, you know, Terra Prime and Demons.
But they were separated by a week. You saw Terra Prime. And then instead of having Terra Prime and Demons as back-to-back, if they're going to do that, you wound up with a part two and then a standalone that a lot of people were going to go hack-pooey over.
Right, right. And the thing about that is that Terra Prime and Demons together, they're kind of setting up a very interesting story. And instead of getting any kind of follow-through or closure on that story in the final episode, we have this completely unrelated thing. So I think that impacted fan perception a lot. And I think what Una said is right, that if that episode had been placed somewhere else in the season, I think that the
Riker and Troy are back on Enterprise and it's a sweep show. Yeah. And it's like, you know, it would have been, it would have been November or a February, you know, sweep show or something.
But yeah.
I'm glad we got that settled 15 years later.
Yes, yes. So Enterprise was the topic of the Ready Room 1. And I did just want to share, because it's sort of like a time capsule of Star Trek. Mm-hmm. In our news segment, we discuss possible villains for the next J.J. Abrams Star Trek film, which is a reference to Into Darkness. Mm-hmm. But it didn't have a name yet at the time. We look at the production schedule and possibility of J.J. directing that film. And we find out why the studio is demanding 3D. Because if you remember, he didn't want to do 3D, but they really insisted. And also, we had Lisa Lynch, who was a writer for us back at the time, who sat down with George Cadero to get the lowdown on the upcoming Frank and Son Star Trek Fan Day. So these were different fan events that we had going on in 2011. So that's an interesting look back
to that. The Frank and Son Fan Day.
Yeah. That was big in 2011, Larry.
What was that? I don't even
remember anymore.
I was doing the magazine. Okay.
Yeah. I will say George is a very nice man, very nice guest. So, and then in the next episode, which we're going to be talking about today, we talked about the future of Trek on TV. Mm-hmm. In that episode, the Ready Room 2 was called In the Year 3000. And here's the synopsis.
Take off
of
on
that.
The Conan sketch, right?
Yes, exactly.
In the year 3000. Yes. Okay.
On top exactly. Of with the...
Yeah, the flashlight, the monster lighting.
Conan's originally was in the year 2000, right? And then even after the year passed, he continued to do it anyway,
exactly,
if I remember.
Exactly.
With the flashlight under
the
chin.
So your cute little twist was to make it 3000. Okay.
Exactly, exactly. And the reason that we did that is because we talked about some future Star Trek television series ideas that had been pitched. And one of them was Federation, which was a Brian Singer pitch. Mm-hmm. And I think Robert Meyer Burnett wrote...
And Jeff Thorne, yeah.
Like an overview draft of it. And that series was set in the year 3000. And so that's where the title comes from.
Because in 2011, there'd been all these not brazenly unleaked ideas that people were happy to spread to the public from different places. Frakes was attached to people I know. Mm-hmm. And this one. And lots of fans were trying to put together. They were all they all now smack of, there's a couple things about them. They all wound up being way in the future, the way people wound up kind of not as far as Discovery is in the future, but kind of thematically, zeitgeist-wise, where Discovery wound up going, even though they tried to cram it in 10 years before Kirk and Spock, but the look and feel of the show felt like it was a couple of hundred years after, you know, or it could have been after that. But some of those, including Brian's thing, were all too, you know, and the animated show that Dave and Doug worked on, that was Final Frontier, that I think you guys talked about also.
Right.
The little anime that was going to be on StarTrek.com before StarTrek.com went south into hibernation for 4 years. But before that happened, they were working on that for that. And that had a similar time. It was going to be 200 to 300 years in the future after a cataclysm had happened, which smacks of The Burn. Now I was watching The Burn unravel going, oh my God, this is their bit. But
anyway,
the rest of those smacked those fan things that came out, whether no matter who of whatever stature was attached to it, most of the other fan ideas that were all over the place in those 5, 6, 7, 8, 10 years were, they hit me a lot the way there was a, on Trek Files, we found the format for a series that had, for 1986, that had Gene not come back to run Next Generation and put his own stamp on it. Like, he could have just taken a paycheck and a percentage, but he wanted to be there and have Star Trek be his thing. And we did a show about how it was going to be basically it was like 10 years after the last Kirk and Klingons movie, Star Trek VI. And it was about a Klingon Federation war, but they were coming out of it. But it was very much felt like, not so much about 23rd century, but it felt very much like a 1986, you know, current vision of Star Trek production rather than Next Gen trying to go 80 years in the future with what all that brought along with it. The same way that format was like interesting, but it was like of its own time without any forward looking vision. All those, a lot of those fan and semi-pro and even some aspects of the professional pitches that became public, in hindsight now, I look back and they are all smacked the same way. It's like everybody looking at what we knew without any new real big spin to it. So for you all to be talking about that is the latest. But that was certainly the highest profile one, the Brian Singer one.
Well, you know, Final Frontier, we talked about on the Ready Room 2, and then later we had Doug and Dave and Jose on to talk about it on a dedicated show. Listening back to the Ready Room 2, it reminded me that before Discovery Season 3 came out, there was some fan speculation going on that somehow the Omega particle, which turns up in Voyager, was responsible for whatever has happened to the Federation. And actually, in Final Frontier, that is an element that has caused like the galaxy to be split in half and you can't get from one place to the other. So I think that may have been the source of that fan speculation. It's something that I never really looked into at the time people were talking about it. But, you know, that's been floating around for a long time, just like the Omega particle.
And used in some of the Pocket Pro novels.
So, okay. Other things we talked about in the news there that are interesting, that one thing didn't happen. They were going to build a Star Trek resort on the Red Sea.
Right.
And another one was...
Well, you wound up having a former Voyager crewman as the ruler of Jordan. So it made all the sense.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that made sense. And another thing we were talking about that's interesting to look back on now is we were talking about Leonard Nimoy appearing in the new Bruno Mars music video.
Is that the one where he's the driver?
Ah, I can't remember now because I haven't watched it since that time when it was new.
Or is that the one that's the tired where he gets up and he's like walking around in his robe? I can't remember where in time they were. Anyway, but yes.
But those were topics. All right. So enough of that. Why don't we jump into some real discussion based on that and talking about Star Trek's return to TV. In episode 2 of the
2011 version. Edition.
2011 version. Yep. June 9th, 2011 was the second episode of the Ready Room. And my co-host at the time, Greg Harbin, he and I were talking about whether we thought Star Trek would return to television at all. If it did, when would that happen and what form would it take? And Larry, these were my just kind of bullet point notes listening back. And then we could talk about this. We agreed that probably it's not likely to return soon. When it does return, we thought it would be animated. And we also thought that Bad Robot would produce the show. And Greg said something very interesting. He said that, and again, remember, this is in 2011. He made the point that live action won't return as long as network broadcast or cable is the delivery method. But once online streaming distribution is a standard thing, then Star Trek will return and it will be live action.
Well, yeah.
So, yeah. But think back to 2011. Yeah. That's not like the standard view of
Star Trek's idea return. Of streaming was still something I was trying to get, you know, it would take a while to get your head wrapped around. But I remember thinking at the time, just on what I knew, that Star Trek would not, especially after it went down on Enterprise, even if you wanted to say, well, UPN was a crippled little fake network that wasn't even in three-fourths of the country, you know, it was markets. But even then, saying that Star Trek will not be on until we have a radical shift. If the geeks may have won, but now we need to, like, take over everywhere and run all the media. but you know, it's not going to be on a conventional budget format.
I think,
but something like at the time, and something at the time, a CBS owned like Showtime, you know, the CBS version of HBO, like that's the place it should be. And that was kind of the most, what we have that, you know, and they still have Showtime. And they, if you notice the CBS business reports, they're always lumping the subscription Showtime in with the streaming app. You know, they always lump those in together, but it's that nature that the conventional, and maybe it's a dinosaur and we'll lose it in 10 or 20 years anyway, now in whatever it, that model was not healthy for sustaining a Star Trek on. The audience was too niche, or niche, as I kept saying in that show.
Right. Well, that's something that Rod Roddenberry and I talked about on another podcast that I used to do called MatterStream. Around that time, I don't remember when we recorded that show. I think it was probably in 2012, maybe, but we talked about Showtime specifically. Mm-hmm. You know, what would Star Trek look like if it returned to Showtime? And you and I were talking on the other side of the room, and you mentioned that this format that we now have, where we don't have 26 episodes per season, we have 10 or 12 or 13. If Star Trek had shifted to a platform such as Showtime, that's pretty much what you would have expected. You were going to have those shorter seasons. Right. So even going back to that point, even though I don't recall how many people were really talking about Star Trek being packaged in a format of very short seasons like that, but some people were, and that would have been part of that shift.
Yeah. Well, and of course, just to remember, we'd had the Viacom divorce. Everything was dynamited. We were also full of, you know, all the speculation about returning to TV was, would Bad Robot produce it? But, you know, it was looming, and this was in between STO9 and STID, Star Trek Into Darkness. I so much love calling it STID, STID. But, you know, there was no hope on the horizon yet for the end of the Fallow Times, you know, for the reconciliation of the Viacom divorce. That was just going to be a fact we had to live with for a while. And would it be a case of J.J. Abrams or Kurtzman and Orci, Bob and Alex, or somebody in that production team going, hey, we want to do a TV, or, you know, an animated or whatever. It's like, if they take the bull by the horns and say we want to do it, as long as they had the clout from the income, you know, the box office or whatever, then they ought to be able to stamp down and say, okay, just the way that originally J.J. is doing Star Trek movies, not because Paramount said, hey, let's do Star Trek movies, because, hey, we want, you know, J.J. Abrams is a hot producer, director. He signs a deal. He's supposed to do whatever it was, 10 or 12 movies. And he says, I want one of my 10 movies to be a Star Trek. And Paramount's like, really? We just decided that it's all old and tired and washed up and needs to go out to pasture for 10 or 20 years, which was silly at the time. But that was
they didn't anticipate that he was actually just auditioning to do Star Wars movies.
Exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Which shows how less clueless they were. But we didn't either.
Yeah.
We maybe got that idea after we saw STO9.
Afterwards, maybe. Yeah.
Yeah. After we saw the product. But that was the landscape. All this talk about what will the next Star Trek on TV look like is all on the landscape of 2011, the backdrop of what 2011's world looked like. And we kind of knew that these paradigms don't stay the same forever. Things do shift. It may take 10 years. And I think in these episodes we were talking about, my prediction was, look, it's a movie cast. They've made no, I know that Bob Orci told me directly that they had no plan. He told me this a year after in 2010, they had no, I asked, and he said, oh, we have no plans to do a TV series, live action or animated. And if that was taking him at his word, if they had no plans to expand the universe, then this would literally be, you know, and they had a three picture deal, the actors we knew about, maybe with an option for a fourth. So, okay, on the surface, there's three, maybe four movies every 2 to 3. And we didn't even know that it would be 4 years in between, maybe, you know, so for maybe 8 or 10 years, we'll have four of these Kelvin movies.
Yeah.
These JJ verse movies.
That's something I said actually on the show. Yeah.
And that'll be it. And by that time, these are movie actors who will be tired of it if they're not tired by the end and they're just obligated. They're contractually obligated. But meanwhile, I was regretting, I want, when I say real Star Trek, I'm not even talking about stylistic. I mean, like, they're not in prime. I want the prime universe developed before I die. Do I have to wait 10 or 12 years to get back to prime storytelling? Thank God we didn't. Only had to wait, what here, about, well, 12 years, I guess. So I guess it was about that. But it wasn't as bad as it, you know, felt. And a lot of people didn't get that at the time, but that was the thing that I was talking about. But they were making what, you know, nobody cared beyond the fan base what it, what was on the small screen. But talking about TV, we were debating, what would it be, Kelvin or the other? And I said, look, they're not, they don't care to expand. They're not talking about doing anything on small screen. So the small screen will just languish. It'll just be, you know, big screen only, apparently.
Right. Yeah. 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 We talked about that. And I, one of the episodes I did say that we're going to have these movies for the next 8 to 10 years, and then we'll get back to Star Trek on television. Mm-hmm. And that was 2011, and we got Discovery in 2017. So it was 6 years anyway. So yeah, it was fairly close there in that.
I was dating it back from like the beginning. So they had the contract in 2006.
Oh, you're going back to,
It starts developing in 07. It comes out in the first movie's out in 09. So I was kind of, basing it from 07, 08. So, okay. 10,
so then
years.
That is 10 years. Yeah. So yeah, it's right there. Yeah. I think one reason, and listening back, I don't think we really clearly stated this. I think one of our reasons for thinking that if Star Trek did come back prior to, you know, 8 to 10 years, it would come back in an animated form is because we felt that the studio doesn't really want to go all in on producing a live action show. Maybe an animated series would give them more creative freedom at a lower cost. And it was a little bit of a safer move. And also Clone Wars was really popular at that time. And we were thinking in those terms.
But again, you were basing that on the grid of a 26 episode full blown year, and you wouldn't make all the investment to do one season. So you would probably at least do two or three seasons to amortize your all your you know, costume, wardrobe, prop, visual effects startup budget. Mm.
Although, have you watched your Lower Decks Blu-ray special content?
No, I haven't got to it yet.
Okay. So I watched some. My discs came on, I think, on Friday, and I've converted them, put them into Plex and all, and I was watching the extras, and they were doing interviews with the creative staff. Mm-hmm. And they mention on there that it actually takes them about a year to do one episode of Lower Decks.
That's just amazing.
And of course, they're working on multiple episodes at the same time, of course. Right. But for one episode, it takes them about 1 year. And that's something that I didn't really... I mean, I'm not surprised to hear that as a creative, but I wasn't really thinking it took an entire year to do one episode. So even if you do an animated show, if you do it right, it's still a significant investment of time and resources.
Yeah. Well, the blow off of, animation will be cheaper than... And you know what? Maybe in 2006 it was, but not in 2021. Yeah. Or 2019 maybe, or whenever they got rolling. Yeah, 2020.
Maybe. But on the flip side, doing live action visual effects and such is a lot less expensive now than it was 10 years ago.
Everybody's, you know, laptop fan film is doing quite well with the visual effects they're doing. Yeah.
Mm. But it is quite amazing what they're doing there. So as it turned out, Bad Robot did not go on to produce the TV series, but some of the crew did. And of course, Kurtzman became sort of the head of all the stuff that's going on. And we did get live action back and we got Discovery. And I think Discovery sort of encapsulates the maybe growing pains of bringing Star Trek back to television.
Well, like the motion picture, like the first year or so of Next Generation. I mean, yeah, that's when you had a gap and they have to get the machine well-oiled. And usually there's a new person running it or maybe a new person who has to get a new team. But yeah, I don't think anybody could predict how disastrously rough the Discovery birth would be. But we've talked about it. And it was not much solace for people who had a lot of issues or they were very disappointed with Discovery. It's it's not, you know, they're like, I don't care. It's whatever you what you deliver to me. I don't have to know all that. It's like, I don't have to read the novel. I don't have to know the soap opera of the making of it. I just need to see what's on my screen. But I, whether you like it or not, that's a fact. And it was very painful. And, you know, I kept predicting that the next series would be, you know, much easier to get going. And so Picard was. And Strange New Worlds, I'm sure, is benefiting from all of that, especially as the second Toronto-based show. You know, and each season of Discovery was infinitely less melodramatic, was less drama to produce, you know.
Yeah. So, well, it's kind of like when you go back to TNG and then you go to DS9 and then Voyager and then Enterprise.
Exactly.
Like each series felt smoother each time. You get to Broken Bow, the pilot of Enterprise, and up to that point, I think by far it's the best produced pilot. It's not my favorite story. Emissary is my favorite story, but when you watch Broken Bow, you can tell like it's so well oiled now producing Star Trek.
And of course, CG was more usable by then, way more than the Voyager. You know, you're talking about 2001 versus 1994. So,
yeah, it was. But what stands out to me more than any CG stuff is how they built the set, how they did the lighting of the panels, how they knew getting an shot from this camera angle is difficult, so we need to build the set this way to solve the problems that we've experienced on the previous series. It just gets smoother and smoother. And like you said a moment ago, Discovery comes around and it's almost like you're starting over in a sense. You're not completely starting over because it does have that Kelvin aesthetic from the J.J. Abrams films, but it is a TV production and now you're building sets that are going to be used to shoot a TV series. And Picard definitely felt smoother. And I have to say, you know, Lower Decks really felt smoother.
Even at 1 year per half hour.
Even animated.
Yeah.
But you know, I think Strange New Worlds, I suspect, will have that kind of feeling to it like we experienced with the series back in the Berman era.
And doing this last iteration of all these series in the pandemic. You know, going into the pandemic and trying to launch the producing season during the pandemic. Yeah,
definitely. We talk about this on here sometimes, how you just said that the launch of Discovery was quite disastrous. From the production side and the writing side and the staffing side and all, a lot of those things did happen. And we're aware of those things. And so we feel it, but I imagine there are a lot of fans out there who would really disagree because what they see on the screen, they like, they don't realize the turmoil that was happening in the writer's room, for example. So it's kind of interesting how also we have different takes on new Star Trek as it comes to television.
Yeah. Well, the coming of Discovery, this is what shocked me the most. I don't know. Am I jumping in here on topics? What shocked me from our number, 19?
Oh, yeah, episode 19 of The Ready Room. Yeah. We talked about the pendulum swinging.
Yes, the pendulum swinging, which I had always used to talk about just going from TOS to Next Gen to DS9 to Voyager to Enterprise. Mm-hmm. You know, and the old maxim there about it's every new Star Trek movie or TV show has to be exactly the same as the last one, but completely different. Now walk that line, figure out that type of and now you're going to do it with a whole new production crew behind you. And we were talking about Alex there a minute ago. This was Brian Fuller's baby in the beginning. And then his departure for all the different reasons is what started this kind of domino here of disasters and you know, mixed opinions and leadership and all that. But what shocks me here is an issue that I had never, I swear to you, Chris, I had thought I'd never thought about this until the dilemma of Discovery came out, because I knew the issues I had with Discovery. I was had disappointment. I mean, I was disappointed that Enterprise Broken Bow, that Ron Moore wasn't in the production team and that would be representing the grain, the deep, deep grain of original, you know, of the DNA of Star Trek before Next Generation. And and, you know, I remember coming out of Broken Bow thinking, okay, I remember going 4 days to Kronos from Earth on a Warp 5 ship.
Right.
No.
Yeah.
But then it got through the whole thing and I went, okay, well, that was like that was like, that wasn't so bad. It's like the one thing that I was groaning. It's like, because I look at it, I'm like, okay, well, we'll have to fix that or we'll have to adjust something, you know, which is what happened. Okay, now Warp 5 is 4 days from, it was such a big story point. It was kind of, sometimes you can massage those things. And a lot of people would go, oh my God, it was one line in a 2-hour show, Larry. It's like, yeah, I know, but that's like a foundational bit. And those kinds of things had come out. Sometimes they're much more obscure than that. One line in a premiere show of a that kind of sets the tone for the whole series. That was kind of a big thing, bigger than it would have been if it just been buried in a random episode somewhere. But Discovery, the visuals and the reaction to the Klingons, which I was able to deal with because I was glad to see some diversity. I was just a little dismayed that they were so out there, but then I'm like, okay. And the fact that they were only 10 years before Kirk and Spock, you know, okay, fine. To me, it was the control interfaces and the smart holograms where you could do a hologram and know what the furniture is in your target person's room and go sit in their chair. That was like, that well, made no logical sense, you know, but
you do know that Sarek had, he had scouted Burnham's quarters in advance using the IKEA app for HoloLens.
Yes. Yes. The famous Pink Ray 4D Holo IKEA app for, yeah. But what I didn't realize, I groaned through that part. Now, later on, you have the Admiral and was it the Europa and the flagship and the Cleave Klingon cutting all of that, that whole interrupted Holo thing. Later on, I realized that the Burnham Sarek thing was not so much Holo, was not so much a holocom, but a Vulcan mind meldy thing. So, okay, fine. We can write that off to that. But, you know, that was my disappointment. And I just thought the, as much as the props were cool, you know, and that they had paid attention to the lineage, I thought the uniforms were really kind of like, do these fit anywhere? So what it really smacked of to me was what I realized was I hear them talk about, you know, and people are complaining about Burnham being a foster daughter of Sarek and Amanda, a lot of that through, but I remembered Cybok popping out of nowhere and people being upset about that. Yeah. And okay, he was a one-off. We never heard of him again, but it was there. And and I remember thinking,
and you have David in the Wrath of Khan.
Right. But even, but at least he was Kirk's son that he didn't, you know, Cybok was like different moms and where was he? And Spock never talked about him. Until, you know, Spock knew about him. Kirk didn't know about David, but Spock knew about Cybok. But my hashtag texture, not trivia. It's like, oh, look, Cybok and Spock not talking about him throws you back into why are the Vulcans, they're not these saintly, you know, Pacific, you know, non-warrior types that
they're
are
not
the perfect,
pacifists.
Yeah, the pacifists. Yeah. I'm sorry. Yeah, the pacifists of the galaxy. There's a lot of weirdness going on with them. And Sarek kind of epitomizes that. But look, here's they were known to us for a century and they were Federation members for a century. And it takes Spock going into Ponfar on the Enterprise for McCoy to learn about something that's not in his database of a members of a fellow, you know, colleague species of the Federation that if he's going to be on our ship, I should have the medical database for them and go down the list of the weird things that Vulcans have done and not told anybody or kept secret. Yeah. So, but that was my point, was that was doable. And the whole species diversity. Okay. Yay. The holograms and the interfaces, the touch screens. And I even jokingly said, we're going to find out in a year or two that smart holograms and touchscreen interfaces cause cancer and they're going to go away just like that, which kind of is a funny way of the whole thing about, you know, holocoms got in the way of our, we ripped them out. So,
well, and the holographic communicators did go away.
Yeah, that's what, yes. Yeah. And then to learn that there was internal dissent among the writers about that. But part of that is, again, the leftover of the wreckage of so many different minds. You know, there was not a unified vision for the show out of the gate.
Yeah, right.
But the biggest thing of all is what this all did was rip off a Band-Aid that I never stopped to think about. But to me, canon is canon. Continuity is continuity. It's the whole thing. And I had thought that in trying to defend the show to people and make peace, because my thing is like, well, the ship has sailed. You're either going to accept this show or you're going to walk away and, you know, excise it from your own headcanon or whatever. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, you know, if you're going to like ignore, if you're going to banish the one kid in your family and, you know, the troublesome kid you're not going to love, you're just going to go with your other kids or whatever. You know, if you're going to do that, then okay, that's your choice. You can do that. But if you want to make peace in your mind, here's, you know, here's how we retcon. Here's what we do. And we'll mm-hmm. figure out things as we go along, or maybe they will. Like the Vulcans were so bastardized in Enterprise, and then Manny fixed the Vulcans, right? The fourth season. Mm-hmm. Oh, look, they had a Romulan in disguise running the show. Oh, that's what it is.
But I would also say that some people may say, yeah, the Vulcans were so bastardized in Enterprise. But if we talk about texture, to me, the Vulcans were mm-hmm. done right
mm-hmm.
because
well, yes,
we find out
in the yeah in the about, midst of it yeah. all unrolling, just like yeah. Discovery, as yeah. things are coming out week to week, you're going, what are you doing? And yeah. I'm going gritting my teeth and going, let's just, mm-hmm. and eventually with some distance and with a change mm-hmm. of massaging ownership and all mm-hmm. that, mm-hmm. and that's what happened on Discovery eventually. But what the initial mm-hmm. controversy showed me was, the showrunners and the staff had all been talking about, oh, no, we're going to be very canon-centric. And what I mm-hmm. realized was they had been very careful to slot Michael in. And what they did with Sarek and Amanda with her was, I thought, was the best mm-hmm. part of season one. It gave me a whole new dynamic on Sarek and Spock. And Spock wasn't even part of the show yet. And it threw me right back to Journey to Babel. About, mm-hmm. oh my God, like Sarek's been trying to manipulate both his kids in the Vulcan Science Academy, and he wound mm-hmm. up losing yeah. with both of them.
Right.
You know? So, but the thing here is, it dawned on me that when a lot of these people said canon, they meant mm-hmm. written conceptual canon. Like the yeah. visuals was just something that's going to match the day,
right.
whatever year we make it. And that had not been the case.
Yeah. The terms you used when we were talking earlier on the other side of the room, screen canon versus script canon.
Yeah, or script canon versus visual canon.
Visual canon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But what shocked me, to put the point to this finally, is I thought that it was all a discussion and a realization that grew out of Discovery and the reaction to Discovery.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm listening to this thing from 2011, and I'm talking about all this stuff in 2011. Chris, how did that happen? Are you sure you mm-hmm. didn't like time warp this recording or something? I'm sitting here talking about, you know, we talk about, I mean, I said all of this then. And I said, now, if they're right. smart, they won't let, because part of this is the dynamic of the creative process. And writers are looking at something one way. But if you have a production designer, a costume designer, a visual effects person, they want to go be creative. They want to be the best of whatever it is they're working. They want to show up their colleagues. Here's what I can do. You know, that's great on Game of Thrones, but here's what I can do in space. I mean, mm-hmm. you've got all that kind of, you know, healthy competition and ego, you know, well-placed ego, creative drive going. But if you have to set it from the top. And I said, this can go two ways. Either somebody running the show says, you guys are going to do the best job matching it. Look at what they did on In a Mirror Darkly to the 60s. But they use new mm-hmm. techniques and materials, and there's corners that are rounded here. Sharp edges are rounded, and it works. It's fine. So that's what I want you to do. Like, do the updating, not in the design, but do the updating in the materials and forms, and then we'll update how we shoot it and film it and edit it and frame it. Or you get all into what year Michael was adopted by Sarek and Amanda, and you just tell the visual people to go, okay, guys, go run with this. Go do what you want to do. And then we'll say yes or no on things. And that's what happened, partly also due to the chaos of all the turnover at the top. And that's what was obvious in 2017 and 2018. But that's I mean, I was warning about that in 2011. I'm shocked. I wasn't bad, Chris.
You were a genius. What a genius I was.
Let's not yeah, talk about canon. I said, if a studio or look, it's not that somebody's out of control. Maybe it's arrogance, but it's the human nature of the creativity of the creative yeah. process that people want to go
right.
be modern and show off and all that and not understand. And I said, you know, any designer, if they're doing a historical piece, and I think at the time I said, you know, if you're a designer doing a story set in the Middle Ages, you go research medieval architecture.
Right.
And yeah. A Star Trek might not be you go back and research 50 years of Star Trek design. You just make a space story because it's, you know, medieval architecture really happened, air quotes, where this didn't. And if that's the way you look at it, that's sad, but that's what has to be set from the top. And if they don't, then okay. And, you know, any designer will do the research. It's just, what are they calling research? And and if they're smart, the studio, the network would set that down and not let it happen. And if they let that happen, then they're stupid, because that'll be chaos. And that's what happened.
Right. Well, it's an interesting question. Is Star Trek a historical piece? And it makes me think about Memory Alpha. So if you go read things written on Memory Alpha, they're all written as if everything is history. It's written at the end of time. Everything is past tense, which drives me crazy as an editor. But I understand why they're doing it, because they're looking at Star Trek as a historical piece. All of this has happened. So if you look at something like Discovery, where there's no doubt on the new series that the writers have made a strong effort, often a painstaking effort, to adhere to script canon, right? To to pull strings from past Star Trek that fans will recognize and make it all fit together. And I think for the most part, to do it quite accurately as was done on any of the previous series, because there's always going to be discrepancy. It's just going
to
happen.
There's always a boner that's going to get through and somebody, you know, has to fix or retcon or smooth out.
But visually, they largely didn't make the effort, or they made odd decisions like having red alerts from the movie era appearing on screens from earlier in that century. That's just an example. But if you view Star Trek as a historical piece, then as a visual creative, you would want to reproduce the look and feel from the previous Star Trek series, because if it is a historical piece, it doesn't drastically change. But it's a bit of a conundrum because, well, first of all, as a creative, you want to do something new, you want to use the latest techniques, you want to update things. And then there's also the question of, if your goal as a studio is to grow your audience, and if you have an aging audience and you want to pull in younger people so that your property can thrive in the future, if you treat it as a historical piece and you don't stray from those visuals that were created 30, 40 years ago, could be a problem, because people are expecting things to be really modern.
Okay,
but
Chris,
if you go really modern, you start to lose the identity that distinguishes Star Trek from another space franchise.
And here we go. It boils down to this. I totally hear you. So two things. Number one, people keep talking about this like it's all design. There's a difference between design and cinematography.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I'm saying here.
Mm-hmm.
And the backup to that is, I was talking about medieval architecture. A better example is, which the one I've used since 2011, is World War II. There were movies about World War II during World War II, right? And the distinctive design of the German helmet, right? And the fact that the Americans had white stars and the Germans had the black crosses and the Brits had the target, you know, the simplified target. That's all kind of the thing. Now, nobody, I don't know, maybe somebody, some wacko artsy, whatever, I don't know, is doing something where the German, you know, they might do a film next year where the German helmets don't look like that. But most of the time, those are the givens of that universe, of that time period. Now, does a World War II movie made in the 40s look exactly the same as one made in the 50s and one in the 60s? And I don't just mean black and white versus color. I mean, does a World War II movie, does Inglourious Bastards or whatever, may, you know, look the same as Patton? Looks the same as The Longest Day? Looks the same as 12 o'clock? I mean, you know, we've had decades and they've all had at least one or two huge and a lot of punky little World War II movies that are set somewhere in World War II. They all wind up looking differently. They all are made of the time that they're made in, with that audience and that level of production technology and the audience expectation. And that's what I keep coming back to. The whole point of Star Trek, part of the cohesiveness of Star Trek is, the conceptual canon, but it's the visual canon too. We recognize that. And if you stray too much from it, that's what I hope was the lesson. I thought it was the lesson known already. Like, you know, Herman's crew in 30 years later, the 60s looked very dated in 60s. But when Tribulations was done, when Enter Mirror Darkly was done, did they try to up? No, they didn't try to up. You know, Tribulations, they had to match footage. But that was not a conceit in Enter Mirror Darkly. And they tweaked. They did some set things that were very subtle. And I wrote interviews and articles where they talked about what was different, subtle things. But it's not so much that Star Trek is an historical thing. It's that it is a universe that we don't think about being so concrete until it's history that's happened. And then it's obviously, you know, World War II, all those different armies and all those, you know, the architecture, the technology of the time, what they could and couldn't do, what was a secret weapon that was testing, what was manufactured in the millions, all of that is a given thing that doesn't change unless you're doing, you know, like a what if, or you're doing an alternate history thing or something. But otherwise, here's the given thing. Now, not that Star Trek is historical like it's happened in the past, but it's historical in the sense that it's a universe that's that. And if you start playing with the universe and monkeying with it, then people, at the very least, people go, well, you're pretty sloppy on your research here. This is pretty crappy, you know, which is what people thought. So all the folks that say, it's in the future, it's not about when it happened. It's what people think of it. And the fact that this is not a one-off, it's a 55-year franchise that occurs across three known centuries that we have definite, you know, there's a specific thing to each of those times. And even over 20 and 30 year spans, we have different differences. It's existing. And part of the appeal of the franchise is that it takes itself seriously that way and did from day one. On whatever budget, whatever time frame they're on, that was at least a concern. And then when you had the chance to match up time periods against each other, that was part of it. So my thing is, people that say it's going to look like what a 2018 audience would want, not a 1986 or 66 audience, I say, well, you know, we've had a new World War II movie every decade, and it's shot and lit and filmed and framed and paced and edited. And sometimes they get sloppy. You know, it was probably more. I remember realizing in the 70s, early 70s, when the movies, like, people sweated and didn't always shave. You know, whereas before that, they had, like, all the actors were clean, you know, whether it was a war movie or it's in an office building, whatever. Yeah. Like, nobody ever sweat, you know, and nobody ever had an unkept beard. And suddenly, the Clint Eastwood spaghetti westerns, people were sweating. You know, and having crap. So, I mean, it's like, that's the sense of, that's the sensibility of the era informing the production. But
it's kind of like when Bugs Bunny stopped smoking in cartoons, you know. There was a time when it was something, and then later it changed.
Yes, so. No, exactly,
Yeah, that all makes
sense. So that's my, that whole debate, that's my answer. Of course, it's been you know.
Well, I think what happens is when you have a studio involved and you have a creative team involved and you have producers involved, you have so many people involved, and people have different views of, should the audience get what they expect in 2017? Should we make it match more closely to the past? There's going to be a difference of opinion. And of course, it depends on who wins out there. When I talk about Star Trek being historical, though, I am thinking from the viewpoint of the storyteller. Not the writers per se, but if you imagine someone's telling you this story, like one person is recounting these stories to you from their perspective, it's history. And in that situation, I'm asking the question of, is Star Trek a historical piece? So should it all blend together? When I think of Star Wars, I feel like, and of course, there's a lot less content to work with. But within the Star Wars,
they have it so easy
universe
on the Wars side,
but they are branching out, you know, like with the Mandalorian now. And within the Star Wars universe, I feel like they've done a better job of maintaining that feel.
Yes.
Like, it's a continuous history. I know a lot of people don't like the prequel films very much, but I thought, like, the ship designs, for example, in the prequel films were absolutely brilliant. Retro versions of the ships we saw later. And they're also careful, you know, with, they come up with fancy new lightsabers, but you still feel like this is a very sensible variation of what we know. It's not some new thing we came up with because, hey, look, cool, we can do this now.
Can I just say, in The Mandalorian, I love the fact that, and again, yes, Star Wars, as much as I hold that up as Star Trek to prey, it's just the, I mean, it's not like anybody is good or bad. It's just the way it evolved. Right. That Star Trek has the math. Star Trek has the numbers. You know, there's 740,000 or 470,000, whatever, hours of Star. Now, Star Wars is starting to catch up. Right. The Mandalorian. They're, thank goodness they're all little short series things. But between the new animated series, I mean, the movies alone, we're going to start adding to it. But the series are where it's going to happen if they start adding up multiple, and the animated series they had. But for so long, there was just so little Star Wars on film versus Star Trek. So, yes, exactly. When they do Mandalorian, they're doing a great job of matching it. And you're right. They have so much less to contend with, you know. Yeah. But can I just say that when I'm watching The Mandalorian and there's some, he's in a cockpit, or somebody's in a cockpit, or they're on a gunnery, and you look down and the graphics looks like the little 1977 asteroid style, you know, the little simple geometric graphic grid thing. And they didn't change a thing. And even though for a second you're kind of going, but I still think the overriding emotion is to go one level. It's, oh, that's exactly like the original 1977 Star Wars graphic. But another part of you is going, they resisted the urge to add on a lot. Now, maybe if you had zoomed in, which is what Star Trek started doing, like the ships in Tribulations, that, and Greg Jean built physical models. They were not CGIs. In Tribulations, they needed them to hold up way better than what the models did in the 60s. You know, plus there was the station and the Enterprise. Yeah. There wasn't even a Klingon model at that point in the original Tribbles episode. But the conceit that they followed, and Mike was so proud of this, and Greg and all of them, it's like at the way we saw the trouble with Tribbles, you see here's the station way in the background, or here's the station in the foreground, mid-foreground with the Enterprise way behind it, right? Or you saw a little AMT model outside the window of Lurie's office, right? But what they did, to me, more dynamic and modern for a 1996 audience, they pushed in real close on the models, and they had like a real dynamic foreground angle of the station with the Enterprise behind it. Or they showed the Koloss D7 there, you know, or close up. And whenever they got close up to a model, you saw a ton of detail that no way was on the models from the 60s. But what they said was, we're going to show you the detail that our scanners couldn't show you in 1967, 68.
Right.
So it was like, we're just adding texture, not trivia. It's like we're adding literally a new layer of texture only because we can. We're closer to see it. And it's not, we're not violating anything that's come before. We're just giving you literally, we're diving deeper. We're giving you a new layer that you couldn't see then, and it makes sense now. And that's, in a reverse kind of way, that's what Mandalorian did. They're like, okay, well, we could have added that, but you know what? We're about at the same level here. And sometimes they did. Other times I think they've done, and when you'd see signage and that kind of thing. But I really admired the restraint that the Mandalorian showed in honoring that in the little ways, which I think is what you're saying there.
Yeah. It's I have mixed feelings about this whole thing. I'm not like, I don't think Discovery should look just like the original series when I go back and I watch those episodes. But I think that what they've done with the controls, and I'm not talking about the programmable matter ones, because that's
no, that's
totally
cool. No,
thing.
They're finally.
But that's also
they're
in
finally
the future,
in the place
so
they should
fine,
have been all along.
Right? But like the holographic panels that they're interacting with in the first season, second season, it's such a jarring difference. At the same time, if I think about the technology that we have today, and I think, what are our control panels going to be like in the future, like in the 23rd century? I think what they're doing on Discovery is probably close to what our reality will be, because already some of that technology is in its infancy, right?
If you look at a console in the Apollo capsule and then the shuttle, and now you look at the control console, and you know, and Mike is an expert in these kinds of things too. Control graphics interfaces. But I mean, that's why the Akutagrams on Next Gen were so amazing. But they were amazing because they were so great, because they did both things. They were really cheap to do. Instead of gluing knobs and buttons and things down, or making them light up, or making them practical and wire, you know, it's just like, just It's one big sheet of film with gels behind it. So you could like just shoot these all day long and stick them, and they were flat, and you could put a little texture if you wanted to, but they were flat because mm-hmm. that's how advanced they were, you know, versus mm-hmm. the 60s slash century before. And then when you see what the Orion capsule has, it's about the same thing. It's like all this flat screen. We have touchscreen phones now and tablets. So yeah, in real life, that's what the Orion capsules consoles are made of. And you see a lineage progression. But like, I would think, don't think of the 60s original series sets, but say the Intermirror Darkly sets. Like, would that have been mm-hmm. so horrendous to have had like 10 years before to lead into that and then shot it, filmed it, lit it, framed it, edited it the way they did?
Yeah.
And even then, it's been 15 years since that was shot and filmed. But that's my right. point, is that the design is different yeah. than what it's built out of, and then how you film it and present it to yeah. the audience in the long run.
Yeah, I think that comes back to the question of what do you expect as a viewer? You know, do you want it to look like what you think your future will look like? Do you want it to look like what you're familiar with? And then it gets into, well, is it a split in the universe? The thing is, I think it would be a lot easier to do Star Trek if it weren't set up to be our own world and our own progression into the future. If it were
oh, yeah.
a separate universe.
Well, like Battlestar.
A completely separate timeline, right?
Like I could care less that yeah. Ron's reboot was not the same as the 70s, because that's not what it's about.
Right.
I mean, yeah. for some people it yeah. was. But for me, one of the main appeals of Star Trek from the time I was a kid was that there was this incredible universe that you felt like you could mm-hmm. crawl into your TV
yeah.
and you knew what it looked like, even without seeing it all laid out in front of you. And
right.
that's the thing that Star Wars is kind of the same, although Star Wars is so wildly sprawling that you don't see mm-hmm. the same class ship potentially five times, you know, from ship yeah. to ship, and the bridge should all look the same on all the class ships unless there's a reason why. I mean, you know,
yeah,
and everybody has the same uniform accoutrements or the same weapon or the same tricorder or across the fleet, and all the Klingons look this way unless they don't, and all the you know. Mm-hmm. It's that way, and there's so much crazy randomness in, I mean, but Star Wars, when you have uniformity, that's the bad guys. You know, it's like the mm-hmm. The Empire. It's like the Alliance on Firefly. It's like the
right.
the churned out manufactured blandness are the bad guys. And you know, but in Star Trek, it's the other way around. The yeah, good guys are the ones that have the bureaucracy.
Yeah, right. Because the Vulcans are the good guys, and they all have the same haircut. So you've got uniformity right there.
Yes.
I think also for me, like Star Wars and Battlestar, both for me, I watch them as if it's all already happened. I'm just being told this historical story. You know, I keep using the word historical.
Historical documents like Galaxy Quest's take on the Thermians' yeah. view of, yeah.
right. But Star Trek, for me, the yeah. appeal of it, you know, the reason I fell in love with Star Trek is that I didn't see it that way. I saw it as our progression into the future.
Oh, I did too. Like, yes.
You know, and, yes. and I think like that's how almost all fans see it, which is why the approach and how you apply it is trickier in that case.
Well, again, the thing that's the appeal of Star Trek to me is that, and as a history, see, and I always say I was not a big, I read science fiction. But I was not a sci-fi person. I was a history person and a NASA kid. So that was a perfect marriage. Every time, I've said this so many times, every time Kirk had a line where he would say, they're talking about Khan, you know, or they're talking about whatever. And he does a long string of when he'd say Caesar, Napoleon, Hitler, Lee Kuan, you know, and well, A, mm-hmm. you knew who Lee Kuan was or whatever he did, you instantly knew what company he was keeping. You know, mm-hmm. but they would do that from our ancient history through our modern history into the future, into the 200 or 300 years between us and Kirk.
Right.
So you yeah. instantly, but that, you know, they would have those kind of lines.
Mm-hmm.
Or when Spock would say, well, you had 4 million killed in your First World War, 27 million killed in your Second World War, and 30, you know, whatever the numbers were, in your Third World War. And it was one of those kinds of things that would thread us right from our past right into our future, mm-hmm. which is their past. And that's what. Those are one of the things that I didn't consciously think about that. And it was just a well-built universe. And the fact that they were pioneering that on a series where they had to keep repeating it. It wasn't like a 2-hour movie and you go away and, oh, Forbidden Planet, yay.
Yeah, right.
We have one production to do and now we're done. It was that they're going to keep this up and keep that continuity going, and that they dedicated, you know, and they made the mistakes, but, and that was the appeal. That was one of the first realizations I had about Star Trek, was getting the making of and the tech manual, the making of especially, and going, oh my God, they planned this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they really put a ton of effort into a continuity of the show. And then as they built more and more additions, that they went to that or told you why it was or wasn't.
And then as it went on, even if it wasn't planned, it more often than not felt like it was.
Yes.
Because they were more careful to fit the pieces together and like maintain that continuity.
Well, a lot of people would still go, so you're telling me that the motion picture Enterprise is really the same thing 2 years later than what we saw in Turnabout Intruder, only with a lot of rebuilding on it? That does kind of stretch, you know, credulity.
They had some rapid R&D development going on, rapid progress there.
It had all been hanging back for a couple of years, waiting for them to, you know, so they could come in and do your cartoon a busy effect.
You know, 50 years later, Starfleet engineers, they refer to that period as the golden days.
The golden days, not the golden years. Yeah, yeah. Anyway, I'm sorry for getting off on that tangent, but
the point is that
I was talking about this in 2011 without even knowing that was coming down the pike. And I was shocked, I tell you, when I saw that.
Yeah. Well, Larry, to bring it back around to the pendulum part, another thing we were talking about in 2011 is, you mentioned how when you're at conventions, this was back in 2011, so you weren't doing as much of like the Portal 47 interactions and all as you are now. But
this was all 2011 was all before, you know, podcasting and Tuesday Live and Portal 47, everything. Right.
We were all just starting with this kind of stuff. So
trying to fit, but it was a brave new world, and you were part of it, Chris.
It was
the post 2005 shutdown fallow years, and you were part of it.
Yeah. When this podcast started, there were very few Star Trek podcasts. I mean, probably I can count them on my fingers and without starting over.
Well, I'm counting them on your fingers actually. Was in 2011 and 2012 when I would ask people in a room of 200 at a con, how many of you ever listened to podcasts? That's about how many people said I did.
Right. Yeah. 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 There were very few Star Trek podcasts back then. So anyway, you mentioned back then that when you're at conventions, you like to ask people, when did you come into Star Trek fandom? Because this often dictates what someone values in Star Trek and also what their expectation is going to be for new content, which really ties into our discussion of the future of Star Trek on TV that we talked about then and that we now have. So back then, we were really talking about original series, Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, Voyager, Enterprise, with Enterprise being the one that had just ended.
The one that, you know, some little girl about 12 earlier. Would sit in the back of the room and like timidly put her hand up. But I would say, it's fine, it's fine. So we're all one big happy fleet.
Right. I think at that point in time, the one that had really been bringing in the most new fans was Voyager. Especially today, when you talk to people, you talk to a lot of people who say Voyager was my first Star Trek. But now today, we've got people who have entered through the J.J. Abrams Kelvin films. We've got people who have come in through Discovery, some through Picard. I know people who Picard was the first Star Trek they ever watched. And also, I'm sure there are people who have entered through Lower Decks, and they're probably really confused because they don't get any of those jokes.
But it's okay, because that's a great voice cast, and they're talented, and it's wonderfully drawn, it's way entertaining.
So I'm curious, like comparing what we were discussing a decade ago and today, when you talk to people now, especially, you know, you have your Portal 47, so you're really talking to a wide range of fans from around the world all the time.
We have a lot of people that chat in on Tuesdays, Trekland, and on Life Support Live on Saturdays even. Yeah, chatting. Yeah.
So when you talk to people now, I mean, what kind of feeling is different today with old fans watching these new series, people who are just getting into the fandom now as a result of the series or the J.J. Abrams movies, which take us back, you know, 2009.
Well, you're right. There's been a little more longevity to the time when people came in. And I had to, 2011 was just about the time I was just starting to be aware of how many people were coming into the Kelvin movies and were new to fandom and all everything organized. I mean, it really hit me at the 2009 STLV Vegas Con, where it shocked me. I knew what I thought about the movie, and I was, you know, a realist and a pragmatist, and it wasn't my cup of tea, but I knew it was, I loved the cast was great. But it really hit me what a great, as I said later on, it was probably the best gateway drug Star Trek ever had, for as, you know, like hitting unaware mundanes who were coming in just from the movies and going, oh, this is interesting. I wonder if there's any more. And this was 2009, so a whole generation had not quite been reared on just clicking in and finding another YouTube. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was starting to get that way, but it wasn't quite so massive as it is now. But people were coming in through the JJ movies, and but in the last few years, it's interesting. People's expectations about where they are coming from. For one thing, at the time we talked 10 years ago, the whole, you were mentioning Voyager, but even the DS9 revolution hadn't happened yet, and much less the Enterprise. I think we had the Enterprise season 5 campaign.
Yeah,
that's Netflix. The whole Netflix revolution is something we were barely talking about in 2011. We were talking more about the Blu-ray sets, but the Netflix revolution, to be able to see all of that, is what brought a ton of people in and was their first. And a lot of people's favorite show shifted. People that couldn't stand to watch Voyager, or they couldn't keep up with DS9 if they missed a show. But binging all those is what made the difference. Yeah. And even Enterprise.
And in episode 19 of The Ready Room, from 2011, you predicted that Netflix streaming is going to be big for DS9.
Oh, I did?
And of course, it was.
Wow. Yeah,
you actually said
that. Guy? Yeah. Why is that guy not making more money today? What happened to him?
What a genius that guy was.
He was. Too bad we lost track of him. No, I mean, I'm trying to wrap my head back around to where people are. Well, here's one thing. I mean, in 2011, I was realizing there was a huge need, it felt like, to connect those dots of the industry and Star Trek behind the scenes and what people saw on screen, and understanding just the way the industry was and the way TV worked and TV versus movies and all of that. And one thing is, I think, right, and I'd like to think that, you know, 5 years of that's been all the wonderful stuff I've done, but also what you and your guests have done. There's been so much. We've gone into such a podcast and a YouTube streaming world. And yes, even magazines and Dead Tree Media still. Fans are so much more savvy now than they were 10 years ago. A lot of that's been alleviated a little bit. And there's a little bit about just keeping up with whatever the newest thing is. Where we got into here, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, was the whole toxic fandom, the toxic tubers, I call them, with the YouTubes. And
this reminds me of something else you said 10 years ago that we should talk about also.
So, good grief.
Go ahead.
No, I mean, it's like just the last 5 years of this 10 years, we've gone through a big swing of, and I did a Trekland Tuesdays live about 2018 or 2019. I called it Who Mocks the Mockers. And it was like when it felt like we were going to be taken over because the YouTube, they get 50,000, 100,000 followers. And we have so many new innocent fans who come in through YouTube. And they don't know. They see somebody with a slick show and they're talking. I mean, it's a great parallel, a great mirror to what's happening in politics. But instead of just attacking, you know, misinformation and fake news through politics, why not attack people and cause confusion and dissension and all of that, things you can't trust, even in your passions like sports or your fandoms like Star Wars or Star Trek or whatever. I mean, the whole, you know, the social justice warrior, oh, my God, reaction to Discovery that combobulated people so much. It wasn't so much that millions of people stood up and did that. It was that in the relatively peaceful world of Star Trek online fandom, which again is not all fandom. It's the slice of fandom that's online and may not be mom and dad and Joe and Jimmy and Jill, you know, armchair fandom across the country where they watch the shows and they buy action figures and novels and comics and they just enjoy the show. And don't know all this soap opera going on online or, you know, the good or the bad of it either way, or conventions or anything like that. But online, seeing this army of like negativity and toxicity rising up, and a lot of people just kind of being blown away and put off by it. Like, where did that come from? And people would, you know, the old fanboy, fangirl argument, you know, the bar arguments for people. Kirk would win. No, Picard would win. No, the Enterprise D would win. No, you know. the old goofy fan mm-hmm. arguments and debates. That's not what this was about. It was suddenly like, how dare Star Trek be relevant and be diverse and be respectful?
Right.
And it's like, what?
Yeah.
And for that to people to realize that was like the whole troll industry. And some, and you know, wherever you want to pin it down around the world, realizing if you can just get in and worm away at people and just make them feel uneasy anywhere, much less the high ticket items of life like politics and business, just do it where they live, in their fandoms and their passions, and make everybody feel upset and put fake news out there. And you can't trust anybody, even on the things that are supposedly small. And that was kind of dangerous for a year or two. And that, I think that has thankfully mm-hmm. swung back. I mean, it was almost a slap in the face for Discovery. It was like Discovery was got popular and got on the radar enough to bring all. It was almost like the Doomsday Machine's proximity, you know, yeah. weapon. It's like if you got close enough to the Doomsday Machine, then it would shoot at you. Right. Mm-hmm. It's like if Star mm-hmm. Trek gets big enough in the social media sphere, in the mainstream media, if it gets big enough, then it attracts it. You know, it's like a magnet for all those kinds of troll attacks. And then once the splash of the debut of Discovery passed, that kind of let up a little bit. But then it would come back whenever there would be something big in the news, like a finale, or a you know, or something big would happen with the show. It's almost like it drew in the incoming fire of those people. But on the good side of things, there's been a rise of podcasters and YouTubers, and now this is the way that younger fans and modern fans interact and get their information. There's been kind of a pendulum swing back on that too in the last year or so, and then we went into the pandemic. But even before the pandemic mm-hmm. was happening, I felt like yes, the pendulum swing away from that kind of crap dominating the ether waves. And oh, I've never said ether waves before. That's cool.
It's a great name for a band.
I feel like I have to tell Dayton that one. It feels like we've kind of reclaimed the sanity high ground a little bit online. So in a weird way, we're talking about 10 years ago versus now. That's one place. And it's like it's almost through they had to go through a ringer to do it. But I feel like we have a savvier fandom. And since more people live their lives, it's not like they, you know, I've seen some people criticize, you know, kids, people for living on their phones all day. Well, you know, like I do mm-hmm. my banking on my computer or all the things we used to do in 15 different places, we do on our phones and our tablets and our computers. So it's not like we're shut out from the world. And in some ways, we're more connected and it's a whole different thing, you know, sociologically, mm-hmm. culturally, psychologically. We can still be too, you know, wired in and we need to get out and see the sun and breathe the air and smell the roses. But mm-hmm. a lot of that's overblown, but that is if we're living our lives there, including our passions, and especially during the pandemic and keeping our sanity that way and, you know, virtually hookups and enjoying our podcasts and our YouTube shows and all that, that it's really healthy, I think, that high ground has been retaken by some sanity, like I say on mm-hmm. Tuesdays, sanity, clarity, and in a big picture, you know, mm-hmm. of places you can trust and getting more trustable sources and then figuring out where are the idiots that are just doing this for the clickbait or the whatever. And that's been a phenomenon that's just been the last 5-6 years and took everybody by storm. But it was doing that in all aspects of society. Right. And across the board, we've gotten our armor up and our smarts up about what to look and not, you know, check the sources.
Yeah.
And all of that. So I don't know. You're talking about fandom. That's one. Yeah. I mean, sad to say. I mean, aside from enjoying new Trek, which we didn't have 10 years ago. Yeah. So now we've got that. And people getting savvy, like we say, Discovery starting off, you know, the most labored birth of a Star Trek series ever. You know, I'll see your Janeway miscasting and I'll raise you.
That seems like nothing, right?
I'll see you shipping out wet prints of the motion picture to theaters on December 6th.
Right.
I'll raise you a Janeway, you know, decasting, and then I'll raise you a Brian Fuller leaving after 9 months and, you know, nobody making a decision and people coming in a month before this pilot starts to film and still making major decisions.
Right. So in terms of the fans, another angle to this question is that toxicity that we were talking about here is probably a mix of two things. Part of it are just pure trolls who pick up on mm-hmm. any topic that is being discussed extensively and interject comments just to create strife. They may not even be mm-hmm. Star Trek fans, right? They're just
right, right.
trolls, strife, right?
Chaos, confusion, right? Exhaustion.
But there are also people who were legitimate fans who mm-hmm. I think were, they really wanted Star Trek to come back to television, but they also really wanted that Star Trek that they've loved from the past to come back just the way that they love it.
Right.
And when that didn't happen, they got very upset and they got very vocal about it. So not to continue talking about that angle, you know, the toxicity part, but the element there is fan expectations. If you think about, you know, a pendulum mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. swinging this way or that, those fans who were with the franchise for so long weren't necessarily happy with the new stuff because it didn't meet their expectations. What do you think about newer fans coming in? Kelvin, Discovery, Picard, going back to the old stuff, because it's been my experience, you know, yes. I've tried to introduce things. I have friends who have watched Discovery or they've watched Picard, and I have friends who have then gone back and watched TNG and they love it. Mm-hmm. But I also have friends who say, ah, that other stuff, it's just too old. And they're not talking about TOS, they're talking about TNG. It's just too old.
It's too slow moving, it's too stilted, it's too static.
And the yes. visuals, you know, we talked about yeah. the visuals earlier. They're like,
we were just
the set
doing this
design,
10 years ago
the
about the original series. Yeah,
everything.
See, that's,
yeah, exactly.
Yes.
Right. 10 years ago, it was TNG and TOS, right?
And it's just a reminder that the world moves on. It's not people's fault that they were born 40 years ago or 30 years ago or 20 years ago or 10 mm-hmm. years ago. Mm-hmm. Everybody is where they are. And yes, that's been a phenomenon. Now, in this, see, that's the sad thing. In this whole miasma of people being upset and aggrieved, you know, and whether they're being paid to be a troll or a bot, even, or whether it's just an againsty thing, or they're legitimately trying to criticize Discovery because they're upset with some of those parts, or whatever, Picard also, whatever, and they're just confused and, you know, whatever the people are coming from and having different angles on things. It's like we've had ships passing in the night, except not ships, more like starships, more like shuttlecraft
starships.
Passing in the night.
Yeah.
For everybody who's an older fan who may not, I mean, part of this is the subset of people who were just pissed about the whole streaming, you know, the whole, by God,
yeah,
God meant for
element,
Star Trek to be free, right?
I think that's faded a lot, though.
Oh,
well,
it is totally
much
faded
anymore.
It's yeah, because yeah. it's because the tip of the spear of streaming, that's all from the folks who had somehow avoided, you know, I'd been streaming for about a year, but I saw this coming and wanted to get into it. I mean, figure out the yeah. whole pair, wrap my head around what this was like to not be on cable, mm-hmm. but to be streaming. And there were a lot of people, I mean, that first year of Discovery, I would see people at cons who weren't angry about Discovery being streaming. They were just confused and befuddled. I'll never forget this couple in their 40s, 50s. And they were just saying, we were so excited to see the new Star Trek. We've been waiting for it. But they only had one on TV, and the rest is on that thing that we can't get. And I guess we'll never see it. They weren't mad. They were just like, and they had apparently didn't have like a grandson to come in and hook up, you know, show them
right.
how an app worked or something.
It's like,
but they weren't seniors. They weren't on Social Security. They were in their 40s. But there's a lot of the country that the streaming tech is still so new. They don't now. Figuring out how to pay for it and how to juggle your budget and all that. That is very much a thing. But it's like Star Trek was the so cutting edge with this, which is funny because streaming had been around for 4, 5, 6, 7 years before that. Netflix starting it. I mean, it was a thing when we did this 10 years ago. But when it hit the Star Trek community and so many people who weren't living on the edge of tech, they some were angry about it, but some were just befuddled. That was a whole part of this. But this thing about we've come full circle where you'd see a lot of people like caught in the crossfire. Like they weren't part of the toxic end of the thing where, you know, the social justice warrior and, oh my God, two women of color as the leads and I'm gagging on this. I mean, that was just horrendously, you know, negative crap.
Right.
So many innocent Star Trek fans are sitting going, I'm sorry, not knowing they're talking to a robot, but they would actually spend their time and energy saying, I'm sorry, have you not watched the show for 40 years?
Yeah. And when you say a robot, you mean that content,
an automated
that
bot.
Tweet is coming from a bot, right?
Yes.
It's just like misinformation to
and
stir
part
up
of, yes.
discontent.
And part of my mantra has been the last 2 or 3 years is like, before you get all excited or angry, or you feel like you have to sit down and whether you're angry or you're just like, oh, I have to go save this poor soul who doesn't know Star Trek. Like, check on their profile and see if they have more than two friends. If they have any photos of anything that's a real person or not just me, you know, check to see if it's a real person. Don't waste your time on a bot or a troll who's apparently has no kids or cats or anything. It's just like angry memes is all they put. That's been one thing. Yeah. But for all the innocence stuck in the middle, and you see the angry end that you think, okay, a lot of that can be, if it's really that angry and it's not just fans trying to sincerely critique who are also trying to stand their ground. I'm not a troll. I just have this difference of opinion about it. Yeah. You then have this whole new wave of fandom and younger and a lot of people who love the diversity and the inclusion, the representation that's kind of Discovery has made itself the flagship for. And that's awesome and that's wonderful.
It reflects their reality and their world.
Yes. And that's great. A lot of older people don't, a lot of older fans don't, and I say older, I don't mean like over 70. I mean like over 40.
Yeah, yeah.
Over
30. It's just we grew up in a different world. It's just it's just a fact, right?
You know, David Gerald tried to have a gay character on Next Gen in 1987. And it didn't happen, and that's in it, and it happened for various reasons, and now we are, and we've caught up, and now we've caught up and slung forward even in other ways of representation, right? Bi and trans, and I'm not trying to put things in little boxes, I'm just trying to get to the bigger point, which is, I have also seen the last year in some of this thing when people get short with each other online, where they're meeting each other, people talk about almost like a reverse swing, which is what you mentioned, especially younger fans, not getting into, and we think about this, we had 10 years ago with the Blu-rays, we're going to fix the, you know, we're going to modernize the visual effects so people don't have that reaction to the original series. But you're absolutely right. There's a whole half of fandom that's not even next gen, but like next gen and DS9 and Voyager, they're kind of caught like, what? They're almost like a whiplashed here by a chunk of fandom that's newer that talks about next gen DS9 Voyager being older and slower paced and static and all of that. And it comes from a sincere spot, but I don't think it's a lot of 40-year-olds saying that.
No.
I mean, I you know, I very earnestly want to tell people that I usually see it more about original series is where it really strikes me. And I get it. Like, I'm used to it, and a lot of people are used to, you know, they, oh, my God, Shatner's acting is so hammy, and oh, my God, they're so static, and it's so, so slow, and it's so 4:3 format, you know.
Of course it is.
And I will say, so I, you know, this came up, and I'll say, I understand. Yeah. Here's one thing, you know, it's like, what would you, I've even done this as a question, a poll survey kind of thing, like, what's the, if you hear that from a fan who's very sincere, they're not trying to argue or they're not trying to pick up, you know, they're not just trolling. They're sincere. I stumbled into a couple threads where fans were, it was almost like I could tell the pain in their voice as they typed. You know, they're like, I really want to try to watch the original series, but I start to watch an episode and I can't get past the first 10 minutes. You know, it's and you can tell the angst in their voice. And I've since come up and I'll say, like, well, like, what's an episode you would tell somebody in that position like to try? Like, what's your best Hail Mary to them to try to get them to give it like one shot? Maybe. I have.
You're asking me.
Yeah.
Of the original series, you know, I often, if I'm asked this question, I think of The City on the Edge of Forever.
Yes.
And the reason is because it's just a good story, and it's the kind of story that a lot of people who enjoy classic movies, for example, might like that kind of story. It has the Star Trek elements in terms of the social commentary, which is, for me, is the hook of Star Trek. And so I think that's maybe like an easier entry point.
I'm totally with you, but not because of anything. It's the one that happens, it occurs the least on, it's still old filming and it's still the pace and all that, but it's visually and story-wise, it's in the least, it's got the least amount of future Star Trek century in it.
Yeah, right.
If they're not scared away by the bridge scene in the beginning, when they hit the ripples, when McCoy overdoses, he runs out. And then after that, the whole thing is on the planet. You know, they're walking around in the ruins and then they jump through. And that's not so, to me, I think that's not, of all the episodes, when you look at the quality of the story, right? Mm-hmm. And it's not some cheap third season cheesy thing or something, but the quality of the story and the thing that's throwing the 1960s version of the 2300s at them. Mm-hmm. And that's, you know, like when I was a kid, the first Star Trek I showed my mom was Tomorrow's Yesterday, because it starts off with the Air Force pilot. It's his point of view. Right. It started in modern times and then puts you back. Yeah. And that was, I thought, this is what I'm going to show you, Mom, first. But anyway, that's now become my go-to thing to suggest to people. But it's not like I'm there slipping the DVD or clicking on the Netflix and sitting next to them with my hand around them, you know, my arm over them going, okay, now let's, I'm having to do it all by remote. But I can tell that there are a lot of people who, and there's some that snarkily go, I can't watch that. But part of it is also, and this is what I tell a lot of people who are likewise, they encounter that and they're just flummoxed. And like, and I'm talking original series. And what you're saying is really taking people who think of themselves as, I found it 10 years ago, or I grew up, you know, they have an emotional tie to Next Gen, and they always looked at original series as the old show. And now they're having younger people tell them that Next Gen looks dated and old.
Right.
But whatever. Exactly. Yeah. I'm looking at the people who are even sincerely verklempt about trying to watch these and not being able to, in air quotes. Mm-hmm. I just, to my own self, I say, in a gentle way, I might tell the person, have you ever seen like Casablanca or The Wizard of Oz or The Graduate, or, you know, like figure out a classic movie that has somehow not, you know, had suffered some kind of, the bottom line, Chris, is the person that's having trouble with this, how many times have they been around the sun? Basically, it's like if they don't have a lot of life experience, and so many people are vocal online, the first blush of that you get, they may not be older than 18 or 20 or 22 or something. Mm-hmm. They may not have had a lot of life experience. There's something about graduating college or having a couple of breakups or having a kid or buying a car or paying for, you know, there's certain things that kind of mellow you out and make you worldwise a little bit, where in the beginning, everything, you know, plus, have you been around long enough for a style to change on you? Have you been around long enough for a, you get to, you start approaching 30 and all of a sudden you start thinking of the kids and you go, oh my God, I'm thinking of 18 year olds as the kids and I'm only 28 and I'm feeling like, you know, that hits everybody in different ways. Yeah. And so a lot of those people that we see talking that way may just be on the front end of that and they just haven't, I don't think it's a wave of fans coming in, but it is a thing out there. And I think it catches a lot of people flat footed because things used to move slower. We had we had shows for 7 years and then they would go into strip syndication. We had the original series for 20 years after it was on. I mean, things used to just move slower and now everything is sped up and the tech changes and we've had a pandemic. And so it's like another case of just take a step and step back and like we are all the great bird's children. Let's, you know, they're here. So let's try to take them where they are and maybe figure out what's going on here. And I think a lot of times when I hear that, that's part of what's going on. And then I try to say, hey, here's an answer. Maybe this is, let them know that I'm hearing them and I hear their pain. I understand their pain. So, but that is very much a thing. That is very much a thing. And now I don't know what to show them from Next Gen. To update that question, I don't know what to.
Right.
I'd maybe tell them to watch First Contact or something. I don't know.
Right. You know, I think something like The Measure of a Man could be a good one, because all you need to know for that really is that Data is artificial. And the rest of it, you don't really need to know a lot about the background. You don't need to know a lot about Picard or Riker or anything. What you can see there is that there is a debate between, especially in today's world, there's a debate between artificial intelligence and how do you use that? And if it evolves, are you enslaving it? Should it have its own rights? And how does that compare to us as biological life forms? And it's a topic that's explored in Star Trek Picard. That could be a good entry point for someone, because again, it's the kind of story that you might get elsewhere. Just to add to what you were saying, two things. One, about life experience, I particularly noticed this about the people who have fallen in love with Deep Space Nine over the past 10 years.
Hmm.
I know that personally because so much has happened in my life now. I'm 48 and I've always loved DS9, but my love for the show now is very different than it was when I was in university when it was first airing, because now I can see so much more in the stories because I've lived all of these things. And I think that a lot of people who didn't give it a chance when it was first on, and then they tried a little later, but they were in their, you know, mid-20s and they didn't get into it. Now they watch it when they're in their 40s and they're like, wow, I love this show. Mm-hmm. The writing is so great. It's really speaking to me. And then the other thing is that I think what you say about a lot of younger fans looking at TNG, for example, and saying, ah, it's too old, I can't get into it. That's very much true. I also know people who are in their 40s who think that anything, any television show or movie that's older than, say, the 2000s, it's old, and they just won't watch it because it's old. And I know a number of people like this. And when you say, well, why don't you watch this show, Star Trek The Next Generation? It's so popular. It was a huge hit. You know, Patrick Stewart's in it. And people, and they know who Patrick Stewart is, but they look at the show and like, 1987, 80, it's just too old. And then when they watch a little bit of it, like, just, I can't do it. And I think that it depends on what someone gets out of a story. If someone loves the story, not the visual element, but the story, what's at the heart of the story, mm-hmm. often they're happy to watch anything, even go back to the 1940s, whatever. Watch, it's because the story is what's yeah. there at the core. But if they really care about things that are lighter and it's just entertainment, then they have trouble with those older stories. And in that case, you know, I don't really know how to introduce Star Trek to someone like that, because short of, you know, the J.J. Abrams films, maybe you can get like the TNG films maybe can work okay. But I mean, if you go back to like Wrath of Khan or something, it's just too visually dated.
Well, I mean, we do have, there's like a strata. It's like an archaeological dig, you know. Uh-huh. We laugh about this now. We say like, well, you know, if it's not in, if it's not 5J pink ray hollow disk, it's, you know, it's like, it was like, well, if there's not a, it used to be like, if there's not a photograph of it, it didn't really happen. If it's only a painting, mm-hmm. you know, if it's only mm-hmm. a George Washington portrait, it didn't really happen. But now we mm-hmm. have, you know, the Civil War. Well, if there's a photo of it, but no, you know what? If it's a blurry old photograph and people are all stoic, it didn't really happen. Oh, okay. Well, if it's a black, if it's not in color, it didn't really happen. Well, if it's not in HD color, it didn't happen. If there's not video of it, oh, well, that's old black and white film. Okay, well, that's kind of blurry, not HD video. Well, that's not color HD. You know, it's like every 10 or 20 years, there's a new level to make something less than. And part of it's just mm-hmm. time moving on and the generation moving out of the original memory hole. Yeah. But it's this joke. It's like eventually nothing. Yeah, and the other joke about if it's on the internet, the 20 best sitcoms of all time, and you go, nothing on here is from before 2000. Yeah. You know, yeah, I'm sorry.
10% of them are animated series, not sitcoms.
Yeah. So there is that, but because you want to say, what about it happened when, you know, there's a thing here. You go back to, okay, older color. You go back to like what black and white movies. I mean, there is a thing. A lot of people just cannot deal with silent movies.
Yeah, right. Yeah.
Even when, what was it? The Artist a couple of years ago, it was a silent movie, Mel Brooks's. Intentionally done as black and white movies. I mean, mm-hmm. that's a little jarring and it throws people. And it's kind of like, it's like a novelty, but actual mm-hmm. of the period silent before there was sound reproduction. And then the early sound movies, which is sad because about half of Will Rogers are in this era. It's like they're basically just glorified stage plays with a static camera, you know, and right. they come in and they it's like they've had a blocked live theater scene. And if you got a close-up, it's because it's either like the important line of the whole scene or you're a star and your contract said you got 17 close-ups. It has nothing to do with the narrative flow of the movie, much less blocking or a two-shot or one coverage where it's like over-the-shoulder angles back and forth. It's just like a static camera and people – it's like you're sitting at the front of a stage watching the stage play go by for a whole 10 minutes and nothing changes. It's very static. Mm-hmm. But there are people that – you know, and so we went from silence to that to maybe more elaborate black and whites, but they're in black and white. And then You know, and that, but that, you know, or subtitle, people that, regardless of the era, people that still, although this has gone away with streaming and captions now a lot, but people that still don't like subtitles on a foreign movie or vice versa, there's some of that that's always going to be around. And some of it is just kind of like you say, let's revisit this in 5 years. Sometimes you can't do a thing for them. But the minute they start to realize that now they're old compared to somebody else, you know, innocent, but still 5 or 8 years go by, 10 years, they're 28 and the new kid is 18. And it's like, oh, I mean, sometimes you just have to let life catch up with them. But in a world where we have so much more Star Trek being ground out, in a world where there used to be the one series and then we had two series and some movies, and the universe was so small, but the mm-hmm. more shows we've added and the more time's gone by, I guess there's more choices on the buffet. We're talking about a buffet of choices, but some of those buffet choices have been sitting on the table for a few hours and they need to be put in the fridge until you're ready to eat them. I guess that's a horrible metaphor. Yeah. But
interesting one for sure.
But here's the thing. We're talking about it and we're noticing it. And the worst thing in the world is, the worst thing is for people to find themselves in a Facebook or a Twitter thread or wherever, a Reddit, online somewhere, and to get crossways with each other about these things, and for people to get, just snap off at each other about that kind of thing. And somebody who's older and somebody who's younger, or they're just coming out of different cultures, or somebody's very much wedded to their identity because they're in an LGBTQ underserved or an ethnic population, and somebody who's not, and they're not even thinking from their point of view. It's just like, you know, when you see somebody snap into a short opinion, just take a breath and try to be the big brother. I don't mean Orwellian big brother. I mean, the understanding big, take the high ground and try
just
to
step back
them.
And, that is the thing. Like, so often people don't look at it from the other person's point of view, which is interesting because that's something Star Trek taught me, is to step back and consider things from other points of view, because there's always been, even if it was just among aliens, there was at least diversity. It wasn't all humans in, past Star Trek. So that helped me a lot and kind of made me who I am, and is why I generally avoid those types of situations, because rather than snap at someone, I'm going to think, well, okay, from their point of view, this is how they see it. This is why they like it. This is why it speaks to them. I don't get the same thing from it, but that doesn't mean that their experience isn't valid.
Yeah. And I was just sitting here thinking, we've gone off on this tangent now for the last 10, 15 minutes, maybe. Like, talk about 10 years ago. Did we even think in these terms in 2011? See, I think this is all, I mean, it's a good thing. It's out there. It's obviously a thing that's in our culture. Some of it came about through maybe, less than desirable memes, but it's all out there.
I think my perception of Star Trek fandom, I believe 10 years ago, was that when I thought of Star Trek fans, I thought more so that the majority of the fandom together felt this way about Star Trek, that the diversity that is portrayed through Star Trek, it's idic, it's understanding other people, it's finding common ground. These are all the things that Star Trek has taught us in the past. And I think I always felt like Star Trek fandom as a whole, like everyone was kind of on that page.
It either taught you that or you found refuge in a place where it was the course. It wasn't dystopian. A lot of people knew it. They just were looking for a place to find it.
Maybe. But I think that was more my view of fandom. Mm-hmm. And now 10 years later, I think there's a lot more conflict within the fandom. And often it does stem, I think, from that emotional connection that you have with the Star Trek that you grew up with, that shaped your life, and maybe you don't connect with the newer Star Trek, and people who came in just through the new Star Trek, they don't know the old Star Trek, so they maybe don't understand why it means so much to you, or why maybe you don't like the newer one as much, and it just creates a bit of conflict. And then that's exacerbated by what you talked about earlier, bots and trolls that are just automated, that are designed to add fire to that, and creates a bit of Discord, but I think that I still think overall the fandom is together and respectful of each other, and it's just this small minority of voices out there, but they are very loud, and it gives the perception that there's a lot more division than there is.
Yes, there was a study, the USC guy that did a study, and it was Ryan Johnson is the case study, and it was Star Wars. And I did that I did a Trekland Tuesdays Live about 2 years ago when I saw his study. I called it Russians, Robots, and Reflections. But anyway, but it was a kind of thing of like, it's the actual, when you pare it down, not to numbers of tweets or posts, but to the actual accounts, and you look at them and you pare it down and you like do one case study, like a certain period of time, a certain situation, look at the tweets involved, and I think it was just a Twitter study, and you actually you find it's not, it may be hundreds and thousands of tweets, but it's maybe 20 or 40 accounts just constantly going, which gives you a clue that it's a troll or a bot. But you shrink it down to numbers, and then you line it up against what else is being said, and it's just that maybe that's only 5%. Mm-hmm. But it 5% from 10 years ago, but now it's 10%. Well, it's 10%, 5 to 10% is a 50% increase. It's still a small amount of the whole spectrum that's normally either neutral or positive. But just the fact that it doubled feels like it got much, much louder. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
And it's accounts. Yeah. And then the individual accounts, and we're talking numbers of accounts, not the actual numbers of tweets, which of course would be a lot more than that. So anyway, it was trying to get your arms around this to say, it's like, no, not that the world is not going to hell quite that badly. It's some people are figuring out the best ways to manipulate it. But the other thing here that's a cultural, social thing also that we're thinking about, like 2011, 10 years ago, we'd had social, like I joined Facebook in 2007 and Twitter maybe the next year.
Yeah,
and, you know, the MySpace and Twitter had been, I mean, MySpace and Facebook had been around since 05, 06 and gradually crossed. But social media, and I don't mean message boards and, you know, all that that had been around with the internet rise, but specifically social media, the way we think of it today, was only a thing from around 07, 08 onward. So in 2011, we'd only been there about 4 years, and Facebook was still that thing that we got to stay in touch with our grandma across the country, or all our old school class to plan the reunion, you know, kind of a thing.
Yeah.
And the dark side of selling your data and what that could get into, and, you know, politically, and just undermining people's confidence and all of that, that had not reared up yet. And it was still all just a fun, new, cool world and people twittering and tweeting and all that.
Right.
And I think the impact of everybody, we were talking about people that get short with each other, and some of these populations that hadn't been represented and deserve the representation, for good or bad, we used to be very hierarchical about our journal. You know, like we used to have 3 evening newscasts a day,
right.
And that was it.
A day, yeah.
And now we have we had 24-hour news, but then we have bloggers, and we have everybody, you know, we have such a diversity, and we have so much now that everybody can pick and choose their news, which isn't healthy. But the point here is like everybody, where everybody used to be, you know, you were quiet in your group until you rose to the top of your group. But even when you did that, your group didn't have a mouthpiece that connected you to the world, much less you personally. Mm-hmm. And part of what's going on now is everybody has the potential to be their own equivalent of the White House press spokesman or something, or the corporate leader or the spokesman of a corporation. Yeah. I mean, everybody's got the
intelligence.
Potential. Or Starfleet. Oh, good old Starfleet intelligence. Everybody's got the potential to have a global platform at any moment of the day. And if not like command the attention of the entire world at one tweet or post, at least to command the attention of an awful lot of people around them. And so we're kind of numbed and drowned out to it. And then when it's something, it really, and somebody just having their opinion, maybe they haven't had a lot of life experience yet and they haven't been seasoned. In 5 years, they'll be more like, you know, but maybe they're 18 and spouting off and maybe they're totally right. And having to wait your turn to say something and represent yourself or have an opinion, you can drown. A lot of things that need to be heard and said maybe do get swallowed up. But I'm not saying the old way is the best. My God, we're having a racial social justice explosion here because we have cameras on phones and things are being uprooted that need to be uprooted and, you know, disrupted. that needed to be disrupted. Yeah. And it's very disrupting to people to see the disruption because they're not used to that, and it should be. But however our comfort zone is about all this, it is a fact that it's happening, but it's not a surprise. It's like, here's why it's happening. And that's something that's different from 10 years ago. We were still, everything still kind of funneled along and eventually rose to the top. And, you know, depending on what it was, you know, we were talking when StarTrek.com came back, there were only two or three. Who all was a Star Trek pundit? And, you know, we didn't have influencers. But, you know, when we were in the fallow years, there were only two or three or four people that would be on Facebook and people would follow them. And, you know, and we have this plethora of YouTubers and podcasters, and it's exploded. And even, yes, early days of podcasting, there was you and, you know, the network you were building and very few others. There was TrekCast and you and the Trek FM. And I mean, like, who else was there in 2010 and 2011? I mean, and I'm leaving people out, I know.
Yeah. There was TrekMate, TrekCast, us. Yeah. Not much.
Yeah. Yeah. You can tell, you know, who the other four podcasts were in 2011 or whatever. So, I mean, for good and bad, but it's a change. And the reason things feel differently and the way things have evolved, for good or bad, it's like, it's just a change and it's where things are. And we adjust, like, who's taking advantage of that, the toxic end of things for money or attention or whatever. And we learn and it's upsetting. And then we adjust and we go, oh, and we move on. Yeah. And it's just that all that's happening so much faster and it's happening globally.
Yeah. Anyway. Well, and also that evolution of society is being reflected in the Star Trek that we are seeing on TV right now.
Right. We're just a corner of what's happening on a big page globally, across all interests and everything. Yeah.
Yeah. And it's reflected in the stories, as has always been the case with Star Trek. And some people forget that. But okay. Well, Larry, to close out here, because we've been talking for a long time, I did want to get an update on one other thing that we talked about on the Ready Room episode 2. Back in 2011, and that is your project, The Con of Wrath, which is ongoing.
It's funny you asked me about that, because if this, so, you know, The Con of Wrath, which was my documentary about this insane event that happened in 1982, 2 weeks after The Wrath of Khan opened, what was supposed to be the biggest ever, most amazing, not just convention, but a show, an arena show attached to a regular annual convention in Houston. In Human Houston in June of 1982, it was designed to be a low budget, not a low budget, but like a shade tree weekend, slow motion, you know, not huge financed project with a huge crew, but a small doable project that we could do over several years. And after 5 or 6 years of filming, 2 or 3 years ago, we were ready to do post. We had a year of pandemic, but 2 or 3 different strategy changes on how to finish it. I can tell you, and I've had people. Some people asked me recently, like, what's going on? The last couple of months, my editor and I have got together, and we've got a game plan now to finish, and we have really been actively working on it. It's odd because you asked me this, Mark Altman on his podcast just asked me about this to talk about it. Just kind of out of the blue, I didn't announce it to the world. I was about to, but, you know, a year or two ago, I'd be hemming and hawing about, well, we've put it on the shelf for now, but we're getting back to it, and we have a plan. Well, we've got a plan now, and we're actively working on it. And I don't want to make a prediction about a time or a date or anything like that, but we've got so much good stuff, and it's so way overdue to be out with you and share this story with the world. And, you know, and the world of Star Trek documentaries has come a long way here just recently, and there's more to come on the horizon with the Center Seat on History Channel from Nacelle Company, and, of course, the Voyager documentary from all that gang that did
to
the
DS9
documentary. And to the journey, yes, to the journey. I thought of you all too, you and Char and everybody.
I still think Tristan and Char especially should be have cameos on that documentary.
Saying it out loud, yeah. Well, I said when they were first talking, and I was doing some promo work with them and getting them into some panels and doing things, and I said, you guys, they were talking about having a contest or something for the title or whatever. I said, well, call it To the Journey. It's got to be called To the Journey.
Yeah. Well, I think what should be the title card should have Tristan and Char shouting, to the journey! And then you go into Sierra.
Either that or the very last thing at the end of the credits, like the cherry on top at the end of the... But thank you for asking about the Connor. It does exist. We are actively working on it back after about a 2-year hiatus because we needed to figure out the end game for the post-production. But we have so much awesome. We have way too much. And we have actually have 2 or 3 people. I had said, OK, we're done. But there's actually 2 or 3 cases that I think we need to get on camera that have come about because of there's a silver lining to everything. And not having done this like in a year, we have so much more in it because we didn't, you know, do this big budget and raise money and get financing and, you know, have a big crew and crank it out in a year.
Right.
There's a lot of gems. And anyway, so yes, we're back working on it. People can go to ConnorWrath.com still and read about it and see about it. And if you've been noticing a little churn about it lately, that's why. But thank you for asking. A little embarrassing to talk about it 10 years later, but that's the truth. We were just starting 10 years ago. Yeah.
I think most of us have some kind of project that we've been working on for a very long time and we can't get finished. So I think people understand.
Well, again, the structure, it's just been a little two, three person crew.
And you've done so much since then building things. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Well, Larry, I think we've been talking for close to 2 hours now, but it's been really fun just to reflect on some of the stuff that we were talking about when this show started back in 2011, again, May 31st, 2011, the airing of the first episode of The Ready Room. Right. And it, you know, really launched the network and it launched all the shows that we've done since. I was doing a news show before that called Hyper Channel, which was me doing video, which I then handed over to Tristan, who I just mentioned from To the Journey, Tristan Riddell, who later did the on-screen and the narration, although I continued to do some of the video on the back end. But The Ready Room was where like this full-on kind of one-on-one or panel discussion got started. And we built so much from that. And when I go back and listen, I hear myself starting out not being a podcaster and just learning how to speak on mic, learning how not to say all the time and learning how to present information in a better way in a spoken manner. You know, I do it in writing, but speaking is a different thing. And then I was just thinking about how that led to so many great discussions and interviews that I've done over the years with people involved in Star Trek and other fans. And it's been amazing.
And the number of people that have come on and, you know, everybody comes in and people put a few years in and maybe they move on, they do their own show elsewhere or they just run through everything they wanted to say and they're done for a while. But so many people come through and you know, you brought aboard for all the different shows in the litany there. And having me back as a guest, I remember thinking about after a year or two, you said your shows are, when you come on as a guest, it's like some of our top downloaded shows. And I remember at the time thinking, okay, should I somewhere along the way do my own podcast or should I just, and at the time I was so exhausted trying to build other things, Continues and Portal 47 and the DAW and Con of Wrath. And it's like, I do not need to throw one more thing on my pile. So I'll just keep guesting on other people's shows. And when I do one, I want it to be something unique and special and not just one more podcast on the pile. And I still want to do a camera show, although at the time that was revolutionary. And now we have all the YouTube channel podcasts out there doing that. So, you know, the Trek Files has been great for something that's kind of a unique niche. As well as the 2 live stream shows, you know, Trekland Tuesday's live commentary and then the show I do with Dr. Ali on Saturday's Life Support Live, Boldly Going in Uncertain Times. So all of this has evolved for me too, in a way, and still coming on and doing guesting with you on The Ready Room, and our lives have gone all over the map over the 10 years, which is another
that's
thing.
For sure.
Star Trek has come back and gone, and your network here and what we've all done individually, life's in and out of Star Trek. And it's kind of been, speaking of To the Journey, it's been kind of an amazing journey. But and just to be clear, Ready Room number 1, I was not part of, but I was a segment guest on number 2. And I guess number 19 was the first time, the first of many.
I think number 19 was the first big long one,
Yeah. When you said, no, keep talking.
And I still do that today.
You still do that today. You haven't shot me yet.
Yeah. People don't know because it's not in the show. Larry's like, okay, I'll try to talk less. I'll try to shut up. And I say, just keep talking. People are interested. Don't worry.
Sound bites, Larry. Sound bites. Yeah. Yeah. Well, yeah. This has been an interesting conversation tonight because at least a couple of areas. What's amazing is when we do it this way, especially this last concept, we were talking about fandoms and changes and different attitudes and how that not only what the attitudes and opinions and perspectives are, but how they seem to have exploded and multiplied. And hopefully how we can keep a handle. That's a healthy thing if we can all keep it kind of corralled and we don't have friction over the explosion of the multiplying angles and the quantity. That's something I hadn't really thought a lot about. But as we worked through it just here tonight, I was like, oh, OK, here's some new angles to consider. But that and the fact that I was talking about visual versus concept canon before Discovery just blows me away. So, yay, everybody, go get out your photo albums, get out your diaries. Go find that amazing thing you did 10 years ago or 20 years ago that blows you away. Cause it's good. It's good to, I start to say it's good to get out the dirty laundry. No, it's good to go back through and this isn't dirty laundry, but it's good to go back through and remember where you came from and what you were doing and saying, cause it reminds you of the time. It's a great snapshot in time, but it also gives you meaning to where you are now. So anyway, thank you, Chris, for having me on to do this anniversary.
Yeah.
And congratulations on 10 years for the network.
Thank you. Hopefully
for the next show, 10, I should say, for the show. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Well, hopefully the next 10 will bring more great podcasts for us. And yeah, Larry, it's been great to have you on board for the 10-year run so far and looking forward to many more. If people want to, you talked about your shows. If people want to catch you in social media or chat with you, whatever, where should they go?
Yeah, a good hub is just to go to LarryNemechek.com and otherwise at LarryNemechek on Twitter and YouTube. Everybody, I got into the YouTube game late, so please go and subscribe on YouTube, Larry Nemechek, and Larry Nemechek's Trekland on Facebook and on Instagram. And of course, I would be remiss if I didn't invite everyone. If you enjoy my perspective, I try to be not the same old you get around the web in my interviews and sharing my archives from all these years working in and out of Star Trek. Join us in Portal 47, portal47.net. It's like a mini con all year long. We were doing virtual trekking around the globe way before the pandemic. And yay, with the pandemic easing, hopefully for a lot of us and hopefully more as time goes on, Trekland Treks day tours of Star Trek film sites that I do around LA will be opening up soon. So check all that out at my site. You can get to Portal 47 and Trekland Treks there. And one more, if you are going to Trek Vegas this year, Terrace Cassidy at Geek Nation Tours and I are offering the one day Valley of Fire, or as I call it, the Kirk Memorial Death Tour out of Vegas on Con Eve on the Tuesday. So if you come over to my site, you can check out and get all at LarryNemechek.com. And get on my news list, even. You can check out all of those things. They're all there. Again, it's a central hub for everything Trekland.
Excellent. Well, if you'd like to catch me, the best place to find me is on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones, letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me here on the network doing other shows. Matthew Rushing and I do The Orb together, which is all about Deep Space Nine. I also have a show called Interphase, which I'm trying to get some new episodes put together for. And also Matthew and I do Literary Treks. Bruce Gibson also comes on and does that with Matthew some. So three of us do various combinations and shows to talk about the books and comics. And then I do other podcasts on the network. And if you go into the back catalog, you'll find me on all kinds of shows, especially in those early years. So that's great if you want to hear more of my thoughts on Star Trek. And if you want to send Larry and me feedback on what we talked about today, you want to share your thoughts, there are different ways you can do that. One way is to go to trek.fm/contact and use the form there. Choose to send to a show and choose the Ready Room, and that'll come to me by email. You can also join our listeners group on Facebook. Type Babel, B-A-B-E-L, into the search field to find the Babel Conference. That's a closed listeners group. And if you're not already a member, you do need to answer the questions and agree to the rules of the forum so that I can let you in. So those are different ways. And the network also has an account on Twitter at TrekFM. That's the username. That's our username everywhere. So those are different ways that you can get in touch with us. If you'd like to help us keep things going for another 10 years, then we would love to have your support on Patreon. That's patreon.com/trekfm. That's where you can find out how to support us on Patreon. And we really do need your help to pay for bandwidth and production and keep everything going. It does take quite a lot of money just to get the basic shows out to everyone. And of course, during the pandemic especially, we've seen a sharp decline in that because people need to reallocate resources. So if you aren't able to help, we would really appreciate it. And we do have big plans for the future and things that we're working on rolling out, but we won't be able to do it unless we're able to keep the current things going. So please check out patreon.com/trekfm if you're able. I want to say thank you to everyone who's supporting us there now, and thank you to our associate producers. And also I want to say thank you to Greg Harbin, who started the show with me 10 years ago and was with me for the first, I think, 85, 86 episodes before moving on to other things. So thank you to Greg, and thank you to everyone for listening for 10 years, and I'm looking forward to the next 10. Well, Larry, I'm going to go start planning for that next decade now and let you get back to making the Con of Wrath.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Well, you know, Chris, this has been some show, but I think it's time to stick a 10-year Boreth temporal crystal in it, because the Ready Room is done.